This recording is from the 26th Annual IBPA Publishing University 2010.
Quit the wrong stuff, stick with the right stuff, have the guts to do one or the other. Our speaker today wrote, lives, and works those words, taken from The Dip, just one of his 12 best-selling marketing books, including Linchpin, Purple Cow, and Permission Marketing, which have landed him on the Business Week and New York Times bestseller lists and have introduced marketers to a new vocabulary that includes permission marketing and idea viruses. It's my pleasure to introduce Seth Godin, the expert who wrote the book on the new age of marketing.
Thank you for having me. So what I want to talk about is helping you see the scary, at least a little bit of the scary way of the way I see the world all the time. And what I do, sort of for a living, is look at businesses, look at business models, look at industries, and take them apart and figure out why they work or why they're in trouble and what's changing. So let me tell you why I think book publishing for 100 years was pretty close to a perfect business. There are basically five elements. One has two parts that you do all day if you are good at book publishing. Well, first, quick show of hands. How many of you are actually book publishers as opposed to hangers-on vendors and people like that? Raise your hand. Okay? And how many of you are the people who own the company? Raise your hand. Perfect. That's who I want to talk to. Everyone else can listen if you want. Number one, you're curators. The key part of your job, the thing that separates success from unsuccess often, is you pick the right titles to publish. There's a lot to choose from. Everyone wants to get a book published. You're going to pick them. Number two, this is the two-part one, you're in the production business. You co-create by editing and egging on and providing feedback and cycles. And two, you actually manufacture often the item or cause it to be manufactured. Make sense so far? Stop me if I make a mistake. Number three, you take financial risk. You are venture capitalists for ideas. You don't invest in companies, you invest in an idea. If it pays off, you get the equity for a long time to come. If it doesn't, you don't get to go to the author and ask for your money back. In essence, you're a little bit of a bank. The fourth thing you do is you do distribution. Maybe you don't have the truck, but your job is to get shelf space. And one of the biggest differences between you and the guys three blocks from here in the fancy suits is they're better at bullying shelf space from big stores and little than you are. That sometimes they're able to attract an author because they can get more linear feet, because they got more feet on the street and more money to put against it, back to that bank thing. So distribution and shelf space becomes one of the things you do. And the fifth thing you do is you promote. You spam the world, you publicize, you flog, you get the world out there to notice that of the 170,000 books published this year, they should seek out yours about a green dinosaur who can spell the alphabet backwards. Right? And if you do a good job of that, and they hear about it, and they go to the bookstore, and they find it, and they buy it, and then the money comes back up the chain to you, you give a few pennies to the person who wrote it and illustrated it, and you keep the rest, and your venture pays off. That's what you do for a living. And what happens is if your business makes sense, and the fact this business has been around for over 100 years and you're still here indicates it makes sense, when the world changes, sometimes you look at the changes in the world and say, how can that benefit my five steps? How do I look at these changes in the world and take them to my advantage? So let's step aside a little bit and think about the record industry, which is essentially dead. Last week, they sold fewer record albums than any week since the 1960s. And it's going down, and it's going down, and it's going down. We don't have a music shortage, but we're about to have a serious industry shortage. If you look at the music industry, and you can see it more dispassionately because you're not in it, it used to be perfect. Radio stations existed for no other function than to promote their stuff for free. Tower Records existed for no other function than to sell their stuff. Vinyl LPs were perfect. They were big. You could show them to people. They wore out, so you needed another one. That if I lent you my LP, I didn't have it anymore, and I had to buy a new one. That MTV was an entire TV network devoted to playing videos that they made for free. And I could go down the list of all the things that were perfect around the record industry. And in 10 years, led by the greedy move to the CD, which then followed to digital, which then led to sharing, which then led to the demise of Tower Records, which then led to iTunes and infinite selection and all those other things, the whole industry crumbles. And all they could do was sue their biggest fans. That was the only response they could think of. And it's over. Put a fork in it. Your industry, our industry, is changing in a different way. And I think that people who are worried that somehow someone's going to crack a Kindle and share an ebook are way overblown. There's something else going on here. Let me try to describe it to you. When we move the very best customers, not everyone, I'm not arguing everyone's moving, when we move our best customers to a digital world, what happens? Well, instead of buying 200 nonfiction books a year, they might read 100 blogs and only read 50 nonfiction books a year. When we move, we know this, when we move a 45-year-old woman over to a Kindle, she buys three times as many books as she used to for less money. But they don't cost anything to print, so things are changing. What's happening is the top of the ecosystem is moving. In Mexico, what they discovered is that when poachers kill the jaguars, the rabbits multiply like rabbits, and they eat all the grass, and huge areas of prairie turn into desert, because just a few animals got killed. Well, what's happening is some of your very best customers are using different media to consume what's going on. Well, what this does is the following. It eliminates manufacturing as a key element of book publishing. That when the best customers are buying bits and digits and things that flow over a screen, it doesn't matter if you're good at chopping down trees. In fact, very few of you make money chopping down trees, but you act like that's what you do for a living. Number two, you don't have to take nearly as much financial risk if you don't have to chop down trees and put stuff in a truck and accept returns. That a huge chunk of the way you think of the world disappears. The third thing that goes away is being good at shelf space. Because I don't know if you noticed, Amazon has infinite shelf space. If you've got a product and you can get an ISBN number, you can get it sold on Amazon. And you get exactly as much shelf space as James Patterson. Someone types in the magic words, there's your product. You won. You don't need to go have lunch with Jeff Bezos. You're in. There's no discussion. I don't think many of you understand the impact of what infinite shelf space means. You're independent. What does it mean? It means you were frustrated with the six big companies that run things, and you're that donut around them. But when there's infinite shelf space, anyone can be an independent publisher. I'm an independent publisher now. I put up whatever I want every morning, and no one can stop me. And more people read what I write than read almost any magazine published in the United States. And it doesn't cost me anything. All of a sudden, some of the air gets let out of that balloon when you think about your role in the cycle. And the last thing that falls apart, which you don't think about, is this idea of promotion via publicity, promotion via spam, promotion via press release, promotion via, look at me, I'm on Oprah, isn't working anymore. Because there's too much noise and too many channels, and your chances of breaking through keep decreasing. So what happens is you look at Facebook and you look at Twitter and you go, I got a lot of money on the line. How do I corrupt these media to use them to spam people about my new book? How do I say to an author who waited to the very last minute, the day the book was published, how do I say to her, now, quick, start yelling at people about your book? That doesn't work either. So of the five things that I talked about that you do for a living in the future, and for some people like Tim O'Reilly, the future is right now, and for other people the future is 2 years from now, but it's right around the corner. In the future, curation is the only one left from the five where someone's going to take you on as their partner. If you're not laying out $100,000 to bring a book to market, why should an author give up 80% of what's coming in? Just because you've been around for a while, it doesn't make any sense. So you could look at this and say, this is really bad news. I'm seeing those little black clouds over various people's heads. I mean, not one word that I've said so far is speculation. Not one word that I've said so far isn't happening to everyone to some degree. Some people more than others. And you can say, we're going to hide off in this corner and we'll be safe. But you work too hard to spend your whole day hiding. There's a huge opportunity here. The music industry had this opportunity 10 years ago and they missed it. You have the opportunity, and the question is, are you going to take it? And the reason I want to leave so much time for questions is I want you to challenge some of the elements of this or try to personalize it to where you are, because I think this opportunity is huge, and I'm hoping that you'll take it. And my second choice is that if you don't take it, you'll feel really guilty 10 years from now because you'll remember this lunch. So, where's the opportunity? Well, what the four things you're going to do for a living going forward are this: still curation, leadership, connection, and creation of a movement. Now, these are alien terms for you, so I want to take them one at a time and talk about what it means. First, I'll give you a hypothetical example. Anyone here published Civil War books? They're pretty focused, rabid fans, people who buy Civil War books. What would happen if all the people who were into Civil War books in the United States looked to you to be the person to bring them the next important book on the topic? What if all those people read your blog? What if all those people came to the conference that you run? What if all those people were connected to each other based on all the digital stuff you're giving them for free all the time, based on all the things you're selling them, phone calls, tours, putting them on a cruise ship, whatever it is. If you were the leader of that community, and then you picked up the phone and called the leading historian and said, I want your next Civil War book, he'd have to be an idiot to not let you publish it. Because you have something he can't get from anyone else in the world. Not shelf space, not money to print a book that will be ignored, but a position of leadership and authority among a tribe of people, a group of people who want to be connected to one another, which is the second one of the new things, connection. That what you do for a living is not publish any book that comes along, but you start publishing books for your tribe, for the group of people who care deeply about a topic. And if you are in that position, your responsibility includes connecting those people to one another. She really wants to meet her. They couldn't meet without you in the middle. And if you are the matchmaker between them, you've built a tribe, a community that cares about where you're going. And the last one of the four is this idea of movements. That if your publishing arm stands for something, if you are taking people in a direction, they will push you forward as much as you push them forward. The new authors will surface from within the tribe. That your job as the leader of this movement is to put things into the world. They might even be printed on paper. But to create the events and the connections and the ideas that people will pay for, connect over, and can't live without. So I guess the question starts with, if you went out of business tomorrow, would your non-employees miss you? Would the world at large say, boy, they really left a hole when they stopped showing up? Or do you just publish in to fill in the cracks? That the publishing that matters is the publisher who will be missed. And the person who will be missed is the person who stands for something, who's leading us somewhere, who's connecting us, who's giving us that thing that's so scarce. And what's so scarce is someone to connect to, someone to lead us. So what that means is that you need two things. What you need is a tribe and permission to talk to them. You need to have the privilege, it's not the right, but the privilege to show up in front of people who want to hear from you and say, good news, it's ready. And then they go on Amazon and buy it. And then they go and download it. And then they show up at the conference. And then they bring 10 friends. And this idea of having permission, that's the asset you currently do not have. True story, Columbia Records, 45 years they've been publishing Bob Dylan. For 45 years, fans of Bob Dylan have been writing letters to Bob Dylan, care of Columbia Records. Where are all those letters? They're in the Fresh Kill landfill. That's where they go every day when they come in. They've squandered this asset. What an incredibly valuable asset. Robert Parker just died, rest in peace. Had to publish a Spencer novel every year to make a living. And where did his fans go to connect with him? Nowhere. His publisher has no idea who his fans are. So every time a new Parker novel, Spencer novel came out, they had to spam the New York Times to get another review written because they didn't know who they wanted to alert. There was only 250,000 people who really cared. If they could have built a connection, just 1,000 a week, that's not a lot. 5 years later, they would have had all of them. And they could have made every book a bestseller the day it came out. Scott Adams, the guy who does Dilbert, every book he's written has been a New York Times bestseller. How did he do that? Well, number one, he's brilliant. But number two, 20 years ago in his cartoon, 15, he started writing on the side of the Dilbert comics his email address. It's still there. He did it originally because he's really lazy. And what Scott will tell you is that all the ideas for Dilbert now come from his readers. People mail him ideas for cartoons. He steals them and puts them in the strip. But what he started to do was create a newsletter of people who cared about Dilbert. How did he know they cared? They wrote him email. They corresponded. They gave him permission. And yeah, there's a tribe. You walk in, you see a cutout Dilbert on the refrigerator, you can relate to this person or not. There's insiders and there's outsiders. So every single time Scott Adams writes a book, the book comes out and he goes and presses the send button with permission to the people who care. Done. Who has the power in that relationship, Scott or the publisher? It's pretty obvious. So the question is, who's got this permission? Who's building this asset? So you want an example? I'll give you an example. There's a publishing company called Curvebender. Has anyone here ever heard of them? Does anyone here work there? Didn't think so. Curvebender is a tiny, tiny independent book publisher. The two guys who wrote the book I'm going to talk about are obsessed with the Beatles. They wrote a 538-page book analyzing in exhaustive detail the recording sessions for every single record the Beatles made. They said, this guy who was left-handed was running the control board. You can hear 8 seconds in, he accidentally bumped the volume up and the saxophone's a little louder. Just exhaustive detail, 500 plus pages. They own the company, they published this book themselves. $100 in hardcover. They printed 3,000 of them. They sold them all in a week. And they went back to press and made more. And they had no remainders. And they're still selling it. They went and sold the paperback rights, and someone else has sold a ton in bookstores since then. But if you look at what they did, it's exactly what I'm describing to you. They sold $500,000 worth of hardcover books at a huge markup, only to people who desperately cared. And everyone else has no idea the book even exists. And that's the model that's going to happen going forward. Because what we learned from the long tail, the fact that when you give people choice, they take it. What we learned from the long tail is there's a lot of stuff out there that's just not being addressed. There are all these people in the middle who are trying to make average books for average readers. But it's at the fringes, it's at the edges, it's at the easy-to-reach-because-they-care groups, when now you have infinite shelf space at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, where you have infinite storage space on the Kindle or the iPad. That is where there's this huge need in the world. There are people who want to be connected, who want to be affiliated, who are lonely, and you're just sitting here waiting for some author to show up and say, here, I have all the Beatles fans, will you please publish the book because I don't know how to do printing? That's ridiculous. You can learn how to do printing on the internet in about 4 minutes, and then you'll find bookmasters and they'll print it for you. That's not the hard part. And money? Well, that's not very hard either, because you can get your fans to pay in advance. That's what Kickstarter does. Go to Kickstarter.com and you'll see someone who has a tribe post a note saying, I want to write a book capturing the essence of my best blog post. I can't print it until 1,000 of you pay in advance. Here's the button. And sometimes it takes an afternoon to get enough people to click on it. So the money thing isn't that important either. And then we go back to the distribution and we say, well, if you have a stamp or you have an internet connection, the distribution part's taken care of itself. So we don't need to organize an industry around keeping a paper company in business or keeping Barnes & Noble's remaining superstores happy. We need to realize that the future is going to belong to publishers who care enough to stand for something, care enough to organize a tribe and to earn permission, 50 people, 100 people, 1,000 people at a time, so that drip, 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 over time they've built something worthwhile. And once you have that asset, the authors will show up. The readers will continue to grow. And you, as the middleman, are brokering this essential service that our society really needs. And the incredible news is Knopf and Random House and Penguin have no clue how to do this. They're not interested in doing this. They're not paying attention to this. They're acting like the record companies, and they're trying to figure out who to sue. And your opportunity is to run in, if you care enough, and take advantage and do work that matters. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. We have a microphone. We have a microphone and plenty of time, so don't be shy or else I'm going to have to start calling on people who don't raise their hand. In the orange tie, sir. Go ahead, and while she's getting that, you can just start yelling and I'll repeat it.
My question is, it's sort of an A to B problem. Because let's say right now tribes exist and they have whatever they have right now. If you're a publisher and you haven't aligned with the tribe, how do you, or group of tribes,
yep.
How do you... let's say you've got a list of 5, 10, 100, 1,000 titles that are a dog's breakfast, and this is your publishing company today. How do you migrate from A to B?
Yep, great question. So this is, the first thing is A is a given. It's what we call in business school a sunk cost. You can't worry about what you did yesterday. It's a given. The question is, what should you do tomorrow? And there's an art in this, that this industry is not filled with accountants. This industry is filled with people with taste, filled with people who can see how something fits in the world, who can envision how something might sell. That's your best skill. So you need to look at the available tribes in the universe and start making some bets. So for example, there are 394 people in Westchester County who belong to the Celiac Society. They're all on gluten-free diets. Multiply that times 1,000 counties, there's 500,000 people who belong to groups like this. So you could say, that's going to be our tribe. We're going to stand for those people. We're going to do what those people need, help those people learn what they need to learn, and we're going to bet on that sector. And then I would take a talented person in your team and I'd say, your job is not to go find me another book to publish. Your job is to go find me one chapter a day that's willing to join in our quest of being the official publisher, official in quotes, the unofficial publisher to celiacs everywhere. And that you pick that tribe, you live that tribe, you immerse yourself in that tribe. And if you're wrong, you're going to waste a little bit of time. But if you're right, they're going to respond and say, we've been waiting for someone to answer our thing. So the first thing you do is you go to that tribe and say, call for recipes. You're living it every day. We're going to do a fundraising book. Everyone in all these societies, mail us your best recipe. We're going to put them all together in a book of recipes. Now, those people turn around and say, we can't wait for that, and they buy it. Now, you spend, this is the key sentence, all your time finding writers for your readers, not doing what you do now, finding readers for your writers. And that flip changes everything in your company. Because that's the difference between a profitable magazine and an unprofitable book publisher. Profitable magazines have subscribers. They don't pay writers very much because they represent the readers. Book publishers have to start over every single time there's a new book, running around for more readers. I want you to treat readers as an asset and work for them, because they, in fact, are the people who are going to push this forward. Now, politically, this isn't going to be easy, but that's why you're the boss, and I'm glad that there are bosses in the room. Then you're going to need to go into the shop and say, okay, we got this backlist, it pays our bills, you guys run it. But this group over here, office across the hall, sink or swim, there's a whiteboard, I want to see the number of people we have permission to talk to for these tribes. And that as publishers grow, what they're going to do is hire one person per tribe. One person is going to be the brand manager for that tribe, or the tribe manager for this one, or the tribe manager for this, and that's who they represent. And we've seen this already happening in the computer book world, because it was the easiest place for it to occur. And Tim O'Reilly has done a great job of representing what computer book readers want, and that's what ends up coming to them, because they speak up. Simple example, as long as we're talking about Tim. Twice a year, O'Reilly runs something called the Foo Camp. And if you're lucky enough, you get an invitation. You sleep in a tent, either outside or on the floor at MIT. Everyone lives together for 3 days. There's not a lot of personal hygiene. And he collects 200 of the coolest, smartest tech people he can and doesn't try to make any money from the whole thing. It's just 3 days Woodstock for geeks. And if you're the guy who's organizing that and you're a book publisher, think about the outcomes. Think about how beneficial that is in terms of finding new authors, gaining new credibility, understanding what needs to be written about, seeing which trends are coming to the surface, being trusted and beloved by the leaders within the tribe. So why aren't there food camps for every single sector and tribe and group that's interesting in the United States or the world? Someone's going to start organizing them, maybe one at a time, maybe wholesale. That's the opportunity of a lifetime. Yes, please. Right.
So, do you have suggestions about an accelerated process for building the tribe?
Sure. The key thing I want to distinguish here, and I'm not calling names, is organizing a tribe around a book is selfish, because it's about you and your book. That the best tribes are organized around the people in the book and the people in the tribe, and the book is sort of a souvenir. That if you change your posture to, how do we reach out to other people? How do we spread this free PDF? How do we create this registry? How do we lobby this thing? How do we get together and just commiserate with each other? And by the way, there's a book. It's a totally different transaction. When people realize it's about them and getting what they want, not about maybe having to pay money for a new edition, their posture changes and they approach it differently. So there's an art here to what it's about. If I think about the success of Harley Davidson during their good days, Harley Davidson really succeeded, just like the Grateful Dead succeeded, because they never sold you anything. You already had the motorcycle. You already were coming to the concert, whether one way or the other. That their job as ringleaders was to say, look, this tribe would be dissolute without us, but together it's better. We'll all go to Sturgis, South Dakota, tear up the town, and Harley Davidson didn't make anything. In fact, it looked bad for them politically to be associated with this. But it was at the core of what was good for the tribe, not what was good for the brand that was trying to lead the tribe. And a lot of authors, particularly authors who wait until after the book comes out, have a lot of trouble getting past 100 or 200 people, because they're not really connecting people to each other. They're just trying to build a link to the world. And that doesn't scale. What else? Yes, sir, in the back.
Hi. If you could share some thoughts on the future adults of the world and how this tribe thing is working with kids and what you think that's going to be.
Great. Did everyone hear the question? So a statistic I heard last week, which may or may not be true, but it sounded true to me. Typical teenager spends 55 hours a week in front of a screen. That's more than most people spend at work. And of the 55 hours in front of the screen, 27 of the hours are spent on Facebook. If you've ever seen a teenager, you can understand why that feels true, right? What kids are learning to do before they learn to spend a lot of time reading is to spend a lot of time affiliating. That they're spending more and more time figuring out which clique they are part of, what they stand for, who, what they're in on, and what they're out of. And this is feeling very, very natural. We as adults look at this and say, you have no privacy, don't do that. I was in front of the Fairway Market last week and I saw a 40-year-old having this angry argument with her 17-year-old daughter. And the argument was about not what her 17-year-old daughter had done, which was, as far as I could tell, pretty horrible, but the fact that she had posted it on Facebook. and that it was the posting that was so horrible, that the publicness, she'll be looking for a job 10 years from now and she won't get it because she posted this thing. But it's really natural, if your whole thing is affiliation, to post and to share. So then the question is, one, will you be willing to join a tribe of people like you? The answer is, you betcha, that's all Facebook is. And two, will you be willing to pay money to be associated with that tribe, to buy a souvenir of that tribe, a journal of that tribe, an instruction manual of that tribe, fiction that appeals to that tribe? And the history so far is yes, yes, and yes. That what we've discovered is that it's not that teenagers won't pay money for media, it's that they won't pay money for pop media, for average media, for middle-of-the-road media. That's not worth any money. The money that's they're willing to pay for is stuff that's about them, that's niche-oriented, and that matches their view of the world. So we're seeing this huge fragmentation. People thought one internet would connect everybody. But in fact, if you look at the statistics, pop is over. The most popular episode of Seinfeld, according to the Nielsen ratings, would not have been among the top 30 shows on TV in 1972. That's how bad TV viewing is dropping off. That pop music, pop books, it's all in the same direction. Every once in a while, Harry Potter proves me wrong. But in general, the long tail is pushing farther and farther out to the edges, and it's teenagers that are driving it because they want what they want, not what you want. That was a good question. Thank you. Yes, ma'am, in the white. Well, you know, the cool thing about genres is that's what they were. They're sort of amorphous pre-digital tribes. You may be familiar with the Red Hat Ladies. The Red Hat Ladies, semi-non-commercial group, you just put on a red hat, go to a restaurant, and act out. And you can find Red Hat Ladies just about everywhere around the world. What Red Hat Ladies want to do is what other Red Hat Ladies are doing. Okay, I'll show you a simple experiment. Just listen carefully to what I'm going to say and then try to follow the instructions while I time you. I want you to clap at once in unison until I say stop. Go. Okay, stop. Took about 7 seconds, which is really good. One group took 27 seconds. I was sweating bullets. But in general, every group can do this. And every group claps at a different rhythm. Because we're wired to do what other people are doing. So for me, the secret of doing genre would be to find a genre where, within circles, people are going to read what other people are reading. That's the secret of the Oprah Book Club. You don't want to go to the club if there's a, you know, even if it's on television, if you haven't read it. Do what other people are doing. So if you're going to do mysteries, the mysteries that really take off are mysteries where you know some other people who are in the circle, and they're going to talk about it among themselves. That's a tribe. It doesn't have to be a hobby. It could just be, I like being around people who like the same books I like. If you can start collecting those groups of people, connecting them to each other, making it fun for them to swap other things. But just to pick something simple, most people who do crochet like each other. It's just true. It's not because they crochet, it's just because the kind of person who crochets is the kind of person they like. And that's the opportunity that you have, is to figure out how you can build those. But it's going to mean changing some of the books you publish. And more important, it's going to be changing completely the way you think of what promotion means. Does that make sense? Great. Got time for a couple more. Yes, sorry, sir.
We've done tribal media magazines and books and events gathered around our tribe. So I agree very much with what you're saying, but take us to the next step. What is it about the ecosystem of publishing, the economics, the finance, and everything that enabled such fat, dumb, arrogant people to survive so long?
Well, I don't want to use any of those adjectives because I still have friends in the industry, at least so far. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But it's about risk. you have to do all the work of a book before you find out if it's going to sell. And that risk, that venture nature of it, causes decisions to shift, causes non-economic decisions to be made. Why is it that when a book goes out on auction, which shouldn't even be permitted, when a book goes out, except it's good for me, when a book goes out on auction, why do they pay a bigger advance than if it doesn't? Where's the economic rationale in that? There isn't one. The reason publishers pay more is because they get deniability. Then they can go to their boss and say, well, I had to pay that much or I wouldn't be able to get it. Not, I paid that much because it was worth it. I paid that much because my peers. So that's all about the risk. And then the lay down. How many do I print? Well, what's that? It's a message to the industry about how much risk you're willing to take. And then the publicity part. Well, we needed to promote the book a year in advance in the old days because the books used to come over on a boat and the sales force used to go around on a car. And all these systems were built to ameliorate risk as much as possible, or at least people's exposure to risk. It's still true. If you want to publish Stephen King and pay him $8 million, you're going to take a really big, fat risk. That's why he's not willing to publish with any of you, because you're not willing to pay him $8 million. He wants you to take the risk, not him to take the risk. So if you look at decisions that get made in publishing, they're almost always about risk and how to deal with it. If you knew a book was going to succeed, you'd probably deal with it differently than if you were taking a chance. And what the internet has done is flip things upside down and made it so that lots of people don't have to take risk. So you saw that horrible I Can Has Cheeseburger, I Have Hot Dog, stupid books. He took no risk to bring all those books out. He's got 1 million people in his tribe who spend hours a day trolling the site, uploading pictures, rating things, talking about it, all of which paid for itself with advertising. The book is just the bonus. Does that make any sense? It's not wrong. I don't think it's rational, but it's not wrong.
I see it moving to more, but it's not that. That's why I should.
Okay, well, the reason that there's less risk is we're not betting on... One of my favorite expressions is surprise bestseller. Because almost all books are surprise bestsellers. There are very few books where they come out and they go, yeah, that was a boring bestseller. You know, maybe a sequel or a presidential book. But in general, if it stays on the New York Times list for 15, 20 weeks, it's a surprise. That's because we're making guesses about pop culture. We're saying, yeah, this one's going to get picked, and it's going to become the hot thing. And then everyone else copies it when it's way too late. Vampires, way too late. Kid witches, way too late. But the first time it happens, everyone goes, oh my God, we got the pop culture lottery to work. And what I'm saying is the future is not going to be about pop culture. Pop culture is atomizing, it's molecularizing, it's breaking into pieces. If I was speaking here 30 years ago, everyone would be wearing the same outfit. Every one of you would be wearing a dark suit or a skirt that looked a certain way. Now, I mean, you can see, pop culture is just crumbling into lots of different directions and everywhere you look. That means that independent booksellers, book publishers, people who are happy with a 5,000, 10,000, 30,000 sale with no refunds, no returns, you're going to win not by trying to win that pop culture lottery, but by saying, we're going to print 10,000, we're going to sell 10,000. We made $150,000 today. Good. Let's do that tomorrow. That's where it's going to go. That's what I mean that risk is going to take out of the equation because you're going to play a different game. Hi. How's the weather over there?
Sunny. I guess, brand yourself or attract the eyeballs when now, like you said before, publishers were curators. They really held the tight rein on the dissemination of information. Now there's, content all over the place and content providers are out there. With you, who has now, the distinction of being the most popular marketing blogger out there, how do you attract those eyeballs when you may have thousands of other people with marketing blogs? Yesterday we had an example of, again, now with new technology, these apps that are coming out. You had the, yesterday, Dominique Brown, she was talking about when you do an iPhone app, you might see for SAT preparation, you may see the Princeton Review, you may see the Kaplan, but at the same time, there may be 500 by just
yep.
people that did did not have established credibility, say, 5 years ago.
That's right.
So how do you attract and then brand yourself as the foremost expert?
Got it.
Or, you know, provider of that particular content?
Got it. Okay, well, first thing is, at least for me, the eyeballs usually come with a person attached, so I try to focus on the people the eyeballs come along for free. I wrote a blog post about this. You can Google two words, first 10, to read it. But basically what I said is this. In a world with infinite shelf space, you're no longer going to win because you have a friend at Barnes & Noble and they don't. Everything is a choice. In the app store, as you said, there are hundreds or thousands of competitors. So how do you win? You can't win by having more shelf space because it's all the same. The way you win, and it's the only way I can think of, is first you get 10 people to look at it. Anyone can get 10 people to look at their work. And if it's amazing, if it's viral, if it leads to where people want to go, they will each tell their friends. And then you got 50. And then you got 250, and then it grows. That if your product isn't spreading, there's something wrong with your product. If you publish a pretty good mystery, it's not going to spread, because we don't need any more pretty good mysteries. There's an infinite number of pretty good mysteries. That if we look at things that spread, what led Twitter to become the fastest growing media company of all time? It's because built into Twitter is the urge to spread Twitter. That built into Harry Potter was the urge to tell other kids about it, because telling other people about it made the book better. That's the key. It changes what we publish. We do not need any more cookbooks. Every recipe ever is now available online. What we need are cookbooks we want to share and cookbooks we want to talk about. Young lady, you had a question. I was just copying you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm now a little afraid. I built a tribe outside of my publishing company. Didn't think that it was going to be a part of that. So I have this tribe of book lovers and book writers and other publishers. And do I now change the types of books that I like to publish to what this tribe wants? And I realize that this tribe actually breaks up into quite a few other ones. So some really love speculative fiction like I do. So I've got that group, but what about the other ones? I can't leave them behind.
That's right.
Because now you're scaring me. I gotta do them.
My job is to scare you. That's my job. So the thing is, yeah, there's a moral component, first of all. These are people we're dealing with. They're not spreadsheets. So this isn't about manipulating people to get what you want. This is about leading people with authenticity and taking people to where all of you want to go. And they will smell it on you if you're just looking at it as a market opportunity. But your choice moving forward is to say, what's the work I'm proud of? What's the change I'm trying to make in the world? Who can I bring along on that mission? There were people who started reading my blog 10 years ago who wanted A, B, C, D tactics on how to do direct mail online. I don't write about that anymore. It's not my job to make them happy every day. It's my job to lead in a direction I try to signal people I'm going. And if they want to come with me, then I can find out where they want to go and we can get there together. So that's part of the choice you make as an artist, is to say this direction is what matters. And come along if you like, and we'll go find more people like us. There's only 1,000 of us. I need 10,000 of us before I can commission Ursula Le Guin to write something. But if you can go get 1,000 more people each, and we can get to 20,000 people, Ursula said she'll write us a short story just for us. That once you start working the power of this group, they're going to be more interested in your success because you're doing it for them. Yes, please. Yep.
And so I have my spiritual life, and I have my avocations and hobbies, and I have my professional life, and things are getting very messy. And I'm wondering about this idea of, do I have a personal persona with a small group of friends that I keep here, and I make a professional persona, and how do I make that professional persona to push my book or to collect my tribe that doesn't seem like it's separated from my person in authenticity?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I don't think anyone has successfully come up with the short answer for it. Right? Because what's happened, what we know is when we put in surveillance cameras on street corners, crime goes down. People act differently when they're on camera. We're all on camera now. And you can try to hide it, but all you have to do is read the scandal page of the Washington Post to discover it's really hard to hide things for long. And so people are changing their behavior because they know everyone's watching, or they're accepting of who they are and what they do because they don't care if anyone's watching. But walking that fine line in between, it's going to be really difficult. Yeah. Exactly. And the cool thing is there are tribes, really ancient, vibrant ones, where that's true. All you have to go to a synagogue board meeting and you'll see there are people in one tribe, but they hate each other on some topic. That's okay. As long as the core tribe stands for something, they'll forgive each other. There are various other affectations and peccadilloes, because the core message is the one that keeps them together. Your job as a tribe leader is to run fast enough in the right direction that people will forget these other side issues. The tribes that are stagnant is where that really becomes a problem, but the tribes that are moving forward, think about any presidential election. As the election comes closer, disagreements start to go away. And then the minute the election's over, the disagreements come back. It's that rush to the finish line that gets everyone in alignment. So that's the motion, the verb that you're trying to create. Anyway, I've used up a lot of your time. I really appreciate it. Good luck with what you're doing. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.